larger, broader Middle East strategy. Ideally, we'd have the Middle East strategy and the ISIS piece would plug in underneath and support it. But the president's tasking required ISIS first. In the end, the combat ISIS strategy was a continuation of the strategy under Obama, but with bombing and other authorities granted to the local commanders. Mattis was worried about Iranian expansion. At one point, he later referred to those idiot raghead mullahs. Early one morning in February, a team of senior intelligence officials came to Priebus's West Wing office to brief him on how to be alert to those who might seek to influence him improperly. It is a standard warning for those with the highest security clearances. "Before we leave," said Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, raising his hand, "I need 5 minutes with you alone in your office." What the hell is this? Thought Priebus. He only recalled McCabe because he had met him several weeks earlier in the Situation Room. Trump had raised hell about McCabe's wife, Jill, a Democrat, during the campaign. She had received $675,288 for an unsuccessful 2015 campaign for the Virginia Senate from Governor Terry McAuliffe's Political Action Committee and the Virginia Democratic Party. McAuliffe was one of Bill and Hillary Clinton's closest personal and political friends. He had been the top fundraiser for Bill Clinton's re-election in 1996. Trump had described the money as donations from Hillary. He had not let go of the issue, talking and tweeting about it later. After the security briefing and everyone cleared out, McCabe shut the door to Priebus's office. "This is very weird," thought Priebus, who was standing by his desk. "You know this story in the New York Times?" Priebus knew it all too well. McCabe was referring to a recent Times story of February 14th that stated, "Phone records and intercepted calls show that members of Donald J. Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and other Trump associates had repeated contacts with senior Russian intelligence officials in the year before the elections, according to four current and former American officials." The story was one of the first bombs to go off about alleged Trump-Russian connections after Flynn's resignation. "It's total bullshit," McCabe said. "It's not true, and we want you to know that. It's grossly overstated." "Oh my God," thought Priebus. "Andrew," he said to the FBI deputy, "I'm getting killed." The story about Russia and election meddling seemed to be running 24/7 on cable news, driving Trump bananas and therefore driving Priebus bananas. "This is crazy," Trump had told Priebus. "We've got to stop it. We need to end the story." McCabe had just walked in with a big gift, a Valentine's Day present. "I'm going to be the hero of this entire West Wing," Priebus thought. "Can you help me?" Priebus asked. "Could this knockdown of the story be made public?" "Call me in a couple of hours," McCabe said. "I will ask around and I'll let you know. I'll see what I can do." Priebus practically ran to report to Trump the good news that the FBI would soon be shooting down the Times story. 2 hours passed and no call from McCabe. Priebus called him. "I'm sorry, I can't," McCabe said. "There's nothing I can do about it. I tried, but if we start issuing comments on individual stories, we'll be doing statements every 3 days." The FBI could not become a clearinghouse for the accuracy of news stories. If the FBI tried to debunk certain stories, a failure to comment could be seen as a confirmation. "Andrew, you're the one that came to my office to tell me this is a BS story, and now you're telling me there's nothing you can do?" McCabe said that was his position. "This is insanity," Priebus said. "What am I supposed to do? Just suffer? Bleed out?" "Give me a couple more hours." Nothing happened. No call from the FBI. Priebus tried to explain to Trump, who was waiting for a recanting. It was another reason for Trump to distrust and hate the FBI, a pernicious tease that left them dangling. About a week later, on February 24th, CNN reported an exclusive. FBI refused White House request to knock down recent Trump-Russia story. Priebus was cast as trying to manipulate the FBI for political purposes. The White House tried and failed to correct the story and show that McCabe had initiated the matter. 4 months later, on June 8th, Comey testified under oath publicly that the original New York Times story on the Trump campaign aide's contacts with senior Russian intelligence officials, in the main, was not true. Chapter 11. Trump needed a new national security advisor, and he wanted to act fast. He said he was getting killed in the media and was convinced a new person would erase the Flynn debacle. Another general, perhaps? Bannon believed the media was Trump's main concern. Everything was through the eyes of, does he look the part? Everything was movies. Dunford and Mattis struck him as Marines because they were men of few words. They got to the point. High on the list was Army Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, 5'9", bald, green-eyed, barrel-chested, ramrod-straight posture, who was the rare combination of war hero and scholar. He had written Dereliction of Duty, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and The Lies That Led to Vietnam. It was a groundbreaking work that indicted military leaders for failing to confront their civilian leaders. McMaster was considered a renegade and an outsider in the Army Club, but no one doubted his bona fides. General McMaster was going to get 2 hours with Trump. Bannon met with him at Mar-a-Lago and offered his usual advice. Don't lecture Trump. He doesn't like professors. He doesn't like intellectuals. Trump was a guy who never went to class, never got the syllabus, never took a note, never went to a lecture. The night before the final, he comes in at midnight from the fraternity house, puts on a pot of coffee, takes your notes, memorizes as much as he can, walks in at 8 in the morning and gets a C. And that's good enough. He's going to be a billionaire. Final advice. Show up in your uniform. McMaster wore a suit. Told you to show up in your uniform, Bannon said. I called around, McMaster replied, and they said it wouldn't be appropriate because I've got my retirement papers in. If he was selected, he would retire and serve as National Security Advisor as a civilian. I got you up here because you're an active duty general, Bannon reminded him. The meeting with Trump did not go well. McMaster talked too much, and the interview was short. Bannon, who sat in on it, later reported, McMaster ran his fucking mouth for all of 20 minutes giving his theories of the world. A fucking Petraeus book guy. In 2007, McMaster had been part of a Baghdad Brains Trust advising General David Petraeus on the Iraq War. After McMaster left, Trump asked, who was that guy? He wrote a book, didn't he? It said bad things about people? I thought you told me he was in the Army. He is in the Army. He's dressed like a beer salesman, the president said. Bannon, noted for his terrible wardrobe, agreed. He thought McMaster's suit looked like it cost only $200 or maybe only $100. Next to be interviewed was John Bolton, a far-right former UN ambassador. He was a summa cum laude graduate from Yale who supported the Iraq War and promoted regime change in Iran and North Korea. He was a regular on Fox News. He reported an income of $567,000 in 2017 just from Fox. His answers were fine, but Trump did not like his big, bushy mustache. He didn't look the part. Lieutenant General Robert Caslin, the superintendent of West Point, was next up. Before he entered, Trump turned to General Kellogg, the NSC chief of staff, who was sitting in on the interviews. General, what do you think of this guy? Bobby Caslin's the best gunfighter in the Army, Kellogg said. Caslin, who had big ears and wore medals on his uniform up to the top of his shoulder, gave short answers, mostly yes, sir, or no, sir. He was like Clint Eastwood. Trump started pitching him, telling him stories from the campaign. Bannon thought Trump was selling this guy. He thought Caslin was in. That night, Kushner said that all the media loved McMaster, combat veteran, thinker, author. But Trump's got no chemistry with this guy, Bannon reminded him. The chemistry had been there with Caslin, but he was a field general with no Washington experience except a short tour on the joint staff in a junior position. We'll get lit up, Bannon noted. They agreed that McMaster and Bolton should have another round the next day and to invite Caslin to the White House later for a one-on-one lunch. The next day, Bolton came in. He was fine, the same, but still had the mustache. McMaster arrived in his uniform. He looked better, high and tight. There was better chemistry, though not great. Bannon and Kushner told Bolton and McMaster to wait. There would be a decision in the next couple of days. McMaster hung around Mar-a-Lago. You know, we're getting killed with bad stories on the Flynn thing, Trump said. Let's just make a decision. I don't think we can just make a decision, Bannon said. Caslin and McMaster are two serving Army officers. I don't think they've run the traps on this. They had to inform their Army superiors. The Army Chief of Staff, General Mark Milley, said that Caslin would be the best possible pick. They've got jobs, so there's a process. No, 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 Trump said. We're getting killed. Bad stories. The media loves McMaster, Jared said. Because he's a fucking liberal, Bannon said. No offense, he has not been that impressive in this thing. You guys don't have great chemistry. Yeah, but you know, the president said. Get him over here. Bannon retrieved McMaster. The president wants to talk to you. Come on over. What do you think is going to happen? McMaster asked. I think the president may offer you the job. I've got to tell some people. I can't tell the president that I can take it. I've got to tell the Army. Just play it by ear, Bannon said. We'll figure it out. That was the Trump way, playing by ear, acting on impulse. Pure Trump. Do you want this job? The president asked McMaster. Yes, sir. You got it, Trump said, and shook McMaster's hand. Get the media. Get the cameras in here. He wanted a picture with his latest general who looked out of central casting. McMaster sat awkwardly on a gold brocade sofa beside the president. A large gold vase holding roses was on the table behind them. I just wanted to announce we've been working all weekend very diligently that General H.R. McMaster will become the National Security Advisor, Trump told reporters. He's a man of tremendous talent and tremendous experience. I'm grateful to you for that opportunity, McMaster said. I look forward to joining the National Security Team and doing everything that I can to advance and protect the interests of the American people. McMaster's shell shock was plain on camera as he shook Trump's hand. I've got to call the Army Chief of Staff, McMaster said to Bannon. Do it, Bannon said. But you've already taken the job. Trump's choice played well. The media saw McMaster was an adult. There would be no more crazies. The president basked in the positive stories. Chapter 12. McMaster knew the biggest national security challenge would be North Korea. It had been on the most difficult list for years. 6 months earlier, on September 9, 2016, President Obama had received unsettling news as he entered the final months of his 8 years. North Korea had detonated a nuclear weapon in an underground test, the fifth in a decade and the largest. Seismic monitors had instantly revealed that the vibrations recorded were not caused by an earthquake. The 5.3 magnitude tremor had been instantaneous and had originated less than a mile within the Earth, measured precisely at the Punggye-ri test site of the 4 previous nuclear detonations. The estimated yield was equivalent to 10 kilotons of TNT, approaching the 15 kilotons of the 1945 Hiroshima bomb. Dispelling any doubt, North Korea's 73-year-old female version of Walter Cronkite, Ri Chun-hee, appeared on state-controlled television to announce the test. She almost always appeared for the big moments. wearing pink and speaking in a gleeful, soaring voice, she told viewers that the regime had built a better, bigger, and more versatile bomb. The North's Nuclear Weapons Center said the new nuclear bomb could be mounted on a ballistic missile, a disturbing claim, although seriously doubted by U.S. intelligence. To compound the potential North Korean threat, 4 days earlier the North had launched 3 medium-range ballistic missiles that had flown 1,000 kilometers before dropping in the Sea of Japan, making South Korea and Japan reachable targets. These tests matched an earlier single 1,000-kilometer launch the month before. 3 was not a fluke. Even with his intense desire to avoid a war, Obama decided the time had come to consider whether the North Korean nuclear threat could be eliminated in a surgical military strike. As he prepared to hand over the presidency, he knew he needed to address the North Korea mess head-on. That successor, of course, would almost certainly be Hillary Clinton. He assured his aides in so many words that the American people would do the right thing and elect her. From the outset, President Obama had authorized several special access programs, SAP, the most classified and compartmented operations conducted by the military and intelligence to deter North Korean missiles. One program pinpointed cyber attacks on the command, control, telemetry, and guidance systems before or during a North Korean missile test launch. These high-risk cyber attacks had begun in his first year as president. Their success rate was mixed. Another highly secret operation focused on obtaining North Korean missiles, and a third enabled the United States to detect a North Korean missile launch in 7 seconds. Officials have asked that I not describe the details in order to protect national security operations deemed vital to the interests to the United States. The North Korean threat had not been diminished, and in September 2016, Obama posed a sensitive question to his National Security Council. Was it possible to launch a preemptive military strike supported by cyber attacks on North Korea to take out their nuclear and missile programs? This unfinished business was particularly gnawing for Obama. His predecessors, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, had addressed but not solved problems that had been mounting for decades. And now the United States had run out of road. The Hermit Kingdom was creating a force that could extend an arc of potential devastating nuclear destruction to the homeland. James Clapper, Obama's Director of National Intelligence, had begun his career commanding a Signals Intelligence Listening Post in Thailand during the Vietnam War. Now 75 years old, bald and bearded with a wide, expressive face, he was the granddaddy of American intelligence, gruff, direct, outspoken, seasoned. Clapper rang the bell loud and clear with Obama. The reporting showed that the new North Korean weapons systems would work in some form. But what threat did they pose? To South Korea? Japan? The United States? How immediate? Was the North just looking for a bargaining chip? The intelligence assessment showed an increasing level of effort, strongly suggesting that Kim Jong-un was building a fighting force of nuclear weapons, or at least he wanted to make it appear that way. Despite the public cartoon that cast him as an unstable madman, sensitive intelligence reporting showed that Kim, now age 34, was a much more effective leader of the North's nuclear weapons and missiles programs than his father, Kim Jong-il, who had ruled for 17 years from 1994 to 2011. The elder Kim had dealt with weapons test failures by ordering the death of the responsible scientists and officials. They were shot. The younger Kim accepted failures in tests, apparently absorbing the practical lesson. Failure is inevitable on the road to success. Under Kim Jong-un, the scientists lived to learn from their mistakes, and the weapons programs improved. Obama tasked the Pentagon and intelligence agencies with examining whether it would be possible to take out all of North Korea's nuclear weapons and related facilities. Could they effectively target all of this? they would need to update the satellite signals and human intelligence. So much was not known or certain. Pakistan, which had nuclear weapons since 1998, had miniaturized their nukes and put them in mines and artillery shells. Did North Korea have that capability? Current intelligence assessments could not answer definitively. The intelligence assessment also showed that a U.S. attack could not wipe out everything the North had. There would be lost targets because they did not know about them, and partial destruction of other targets. The Greater Seoul Megalopolis was home to approximately 10 million people and went right up to the 2.5-mile-wide Demilitarized Zone, DMZ, dividing North and South Korea. North Korea had thousands of artillery pieces near the DMZ in caves. In exercises, the North Koreans wheeled the artillery out, practiced shooting, and went back into the caves. This was called shoot and scoot. Could a U.S. attack deal with so many weapons? After a month of study, U.S. intelligence and the Pentagon formally reported to Obama that perhaps 85% of all known nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons facilities could be attacked and destroyed, and that was only the identified ones. Clapper believed the projected success rate would have to be perfect. A single North Korean nuclear weapon detonated in response could mean tens of thousands of casualties in South Korea. Any U.S. attack could also trigger the North's potentially devastating artillery, other conventional weapons, and a ground army of at least 200,000 and many more volunteers. The Pentagon reported that the only way to locate and destroy with complete certainty all components of North Korea's nuclear program was through a ground invasion. A ground invasion would trigger a North Korean response, likely with a nuclear weapon. That was unthinkable to Obama. In his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in 2009, he said, "War promises human tragedy," and "War, at some level, is an expression of human folly." Frustrated and exasperated, he rejected a preemptive strike. It was folly. Informal back-channel diplomacy between the United States and North Korea continued. Former U.S. government officials met with current North Korean officials to keep a dialogue open. These were most often called Track 1.5 meetings. Government-to-government meetings were called Track 1. If both sides were non-government or former officials, these meetings were called Track 2. "We're has-beens, but they're not," in the words of one former U.S. official deeply involved in the Track 1.5 meetings. One meeting had been held recently in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, with the Vice Foreign Minister of North Korea. Former U.S. negotiator Robert Gallucci said the North Koreans warned him at this meeting, "They will always be a nuclear weapons state." A second Track 1.5 meeting with the head of North Korea's American Affairs Division followed the 2016 election and took place in Geneva. "The North Koreans don't take it seriously," said one former U.S. official, "because they know the U.S. representatives can't propose anything new. But they're probably better than not having the meetings." Trump had a history of public statements about North Korea dating back to an October 1999 Meet the Press appearance. "I would negotiate like crazy," Trump said. In a 2016 campaign speech, he said, "President Obama watches helplessly as North Korea increases its aggression and expands even further with its nuclear reach." In May of 2016, he told Reuters, "I would have no problem speaking to Kim Jong-un." As president in 2017, he called Kim a smart cookie. Without a tenable military option, DNI Clapper thought the U.S. needed to be more realistic. In November 2014, he had gone to North Korea to retrieve two U.S. citizens who had been taken prisoner. From his discussions with North Korean officials, he was convinced that North Korea would not give up their nuclear weapons. Why would they? In exchange for what? North Korea had effectively bought a deterrent. It was real and powerful in its ambiguity. U.S. intelligence was not certain of the capability. He had argued to Obama and the NSC that for the United States to say that denuclearization was a condition for negotiations was not working and would not work. Also, Clapper said, he understood the North Korean desire for a peace treaty to end the Korean War, which had been formally resolved with an armistice in 1953, a truce between the commanders of the militaries involved, not the nations at war. The United States needed to understand how North Korea looked at the situation. The U.S. and South Korea seemed permanently poised, dramatically at times, to attack and to do away with the Kim regime. There was a single argument he made, Clapper said, that the North Koreans had not pushed back on during his 2014 visit. The United States, he had argued, has no permanent enemies. Look, he said, we had a war with Japan and Germany, but now are friends with both. We had a war with Vietnam, but now we are friends. Clapper had recently visited Vietnam. Even after a full-scale war, peaceful coexistence was possible. Clapper wanted the U.S. to set up an interest section in Pyongyang. This would be an informal channel in which another government with an embassy in the North Korean capital would act as intermediary. It would be less than full diplomatic relations, but it would give the U.S. a base, a place in the capital where they could obtain information and also get information into North Korea. Clapper was a voice in the wilderness. No one agreed. Obama was hard line. North Korea would have to agree to give up its nuclear weapons. Obama, a determined advocate for reducing nuclear weapons worldwide, wanted to turn the clock back. He condemned the North's September 9th nuclear test in a long public statement repeating U.S. policy. To be clear, the United States does not and never will accept North Korea as a nuclear state. The overriding fact, Clapper argued, was that no one really understood what drove Kim Jong-un. No one knows his ignition point, he said. That was the assessment they needed and didn't have. Instead, the analysts debated whether Kim Jong-un was a brilliant, strategic genius manipulating other countries, including the U.S., or an inexperienced, impulsive fool. As the Obama administration fanned through possible options, the discussion turned to the possibility of increasing the cyber attacks on North Korea. Some viewed cyber as the below-the-radar magic wand that might mitigate the North Korean threat. To launch broader cyber attacks effectively, the National Security Agency would have to go through servers that North Korea had in China. The Chinese would detect such an attack and could conclude it was directed at them, potentially unleashing a cataclysmic cyber war. I can't promise you that we can absorb a cyber counterattack, one senior Obama cabinet member told Obama. And that was a big problem. The use of cyber could trigger escalation and set off a round of attacks and counterattacks that could cripple the internet, financial systems like banking and credit cards, power grids, news and other communications systems, potentially bringing the American or even the world economy to its knees. The administration lawyers who had the top security clearances and were involved in the discussion objected strenuously. It was too risky. Little new happened. North Korea's cyber capability had been demonstrated powerfully in a 2014 attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment designed to stop the release of a satirical movie about Kim Jong-un. The movie, a comedy called The Interview, depicted two journalists going to North Korea to assassinate the youthful dictator. Investigators later discovered that North Korean hackers had lurked inside Sony's networks for 3 months, waiting to attack. On November 24th, North Korea took over Sony's computer screens. To maximize shock value, the screens displayed a menacing red skeleton coming at the viewer and the text, "Hacked by #GOP, short for Guardians of Peace," stating, We've already warned you, and this is just a beginning. North Korean hackers destroyed 70% or more of Sony's computers, including laptops. Employing thousands of hackers, the North was now regularly using cyber programs to steal hundreds of millions of dollars from banks and others on a global scale. 2 days after the election, Obama and Trump met at the White House. The meeting was intended to last for 20 minutes, but it continued for over an hour. "Korea is going to be the biggest, most important thing you've got going," Obama told the president-elect. "It's my biggest headache." Trump told staff later that Obama warned him that North Korea will be your biggest nightmare. One intelligence analyst with vast experience and who also had served in South Korea said, "I'm shocked that the Obama administration closed their eyes and acted like the deaf, mute, and blind monkey on this issue. And now I understand why the Obama team said to Trump that the major problem you have is North Korean nukes. They've been hiding the problem." Chapter 13. In February, General Dunford stopped by the office of Senator Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina Republican, for a private talk. Probably few in the Senate worked harder on military matters than Graham. A bachelor and colonel in the Air Force Reserve, he seemed always on duty. He had built a vast bipartisan network in Washington. Former Vice President Joe Biden, who had served 36 years in the Senate, said that Graham had the best instincts of anyone in the upper chamber. Graham, 61, a senior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, was best friend and virtual permanent sidekick to the committee's chairman, the outspoken Senator John McCain. When Dunford arrived at Graham's office, Graham could see that the chairman was shaken. Trump was asking for a new war plan for a preemptive military strike on North Korea, Dunford confided. "The intelligence on North Korea was not good enough," Dunford said. "We need better intelligence before I give the president a plan." A Marine and combat veteran and former commandant of the Marine Corps, Dunford had served as commander of the 5th Marine Regiment during the 2003 invasion of Iraq. His nickname was Fighting Joe, and he had served under then-Major General James Mattis. He was clearly rattled by Trump's impulsive decision-making style. Graham sensed that Dunford was stalling Trump's request, given the risk. Graham had a contentious relationship with Trump during the primaries. One of 16 besides Trump running for the Republican nomination, Graham had not made it past the second tier. He'd called Trump a jackass, and in retaliation, Trump gave out his cell phone number at a campaign rally in South Carolina, flooding his phone with so many calls that Graham destroyed it in a comic video. He endorsed Jeb Bush, contrasting him to Trump. "Bush hasn't tried to get ahead in a contested primary by throwing dangerous rhetoric around." Priebus urged Graham to build a relationship with Trump. "One of the selling points," he told Graham, "you're a lot of fun. He needs fun people around him." Graham was pounding Trump pretty hard, especially on the first executive order on the Muslim ban. "Some third grader wrote it on the back of an envelope," he said. Graham and McCain had released a joint statement. "We fear this executive order will become a self-inflicted wound in the fight against terrorism. This executive order sends a signal, intended or not, that America does not want Muslims coming into our country. That is why we fear this executive order may do more to help terrorist recruitment than improve our security." Graham was now willing to put the past behind. Several weeks later, on March 7th, Trump invited Graham to lunch at the White House. Graham had prepared a little speech. When he walked into the Oval Office, Trump was sitting behind the Resolute desk. He jumped up, moved swiftly toward Graham, and gave him a big hug. "We've got to be friends," Trump said. "You're going to be my friend." "Yes, sir," Graham replied. "I want to be your friend." Trump said he shouldn't have publicly given out Graham's cell phone number. That was the highlight of my campaign, Graham joked. What's your new number? Trump asked. He wrote it down, laughed, and asked how their rift had occurred. It was a contest, Graham said. You know I never got any traction. I couldn't get on the big stage. Now you won. I'm humbled by being beat, and I accept your victory. He knew this was what Trump wanted to hear. Do you want me to help you? Trump said he did. Before we go into lunch, Graham said, I want to apologize to you for a very fucked up Republican majority. Congress is going to fuck up your presidency. We have no idea what we're doing. We have no plan for health care. We're on different planets when it comes to cutting taxes, and you're the biggest loser in this. Tax reform and a replacement for Obamacare should have been done years ago. Now, you're the one who can do it. You're a deal maker. These leaders in Congress don't know how to do something as simple as buying a house. If there was ever a time for a deal maker, this is it. There are a lot of good people, but most of them never made a deal in the private sector. There are not five people on Capitol Hill I'd let buy me a car. I'd let you buy me a car. And here's what I want to convince you of, that you'd let me buy you a car. They went into the adjoining dining room. The large TV screen was tuned to the Fox cable channel with the sound off. McMaster and Priebus joined them. What's on your mind? Trump asked. Short term, North Korea, Graham said. There'll come a day when somebody's going to come in and say, Mr. President, they're on the verge of getting a missile. They've miniaturized a nuclear weapon to put on it. They can hit the homeland. What do you want us to do? Suddenly, everyone's attention was drawn to four North Korean missiles shooting across the giant TV screen. Just days before, on March 5th, North Korea had fired four missiles into the Sea of Japan. Trump's eyes were as big as silver dollars. That's old footage. Old footage, Graham said, trying to calm everyone. He had seen it before. I've got to do something about this, Trump said, pointing to the screen. That day is coming, Graham said. What are you going to do about it? What do you think I should do about it? He asked. You can accept they've got a missile, and tell them and China that if you ever use it, that's the end of North Korea, Graham said. And have a missile defense system that has a high percentage of knocking it down. That's scenario one. Scenario two is that you tell China that we're not going to let them get such a missile to hit our homeland. And if you don't take care of it, I will. What would you do? The president asked. It had to be the second option, Graham said. You can't let them have that capability. Number one is too risky. The president leaned toward McMaster. What do you think? I think he's right, the national security advisor said. If it gets to be a mature threat, Graham said, don't let us, Congress, just sit on the sidelines and bitch and moan. If you have the evidence, the day that they come in and tell you that, you call the congressional leadership up and say, I may have to use force here. Let me tell you why I want your backing for authorization to use force against North Korea. If we had a vote that was decisive and you had that authority in your back pocket, it may prevent you from having to use it. That'd be very provocative, Priebus said. It's meant to be provocative, Graham replied. You only do that as a last resort. That will get everyone worried and excited, Priebus said. I don't give a shit who I make nervous, Trump said. You don't want it on your resume that North Korea, a nuclear power, got a missile that could reach the United States on your watch, Graham said. Trump said he had been thinking about that. If they have a breakout, Graham said, and have a missile that will reach the United States, you've got to whack them. If you get congressional authorization, you've got something in your back pocket. It would be an intermediate step and would give Trump leverage. They think if they get a missile with a nuclear weapon on top, they're home free. You've got to convince them if they try to get a missile with a weapon on top, that's the end of them. McMaster said that the intelligence on North Korea was incomplete. "Call me before you shoot," Graham told them. Graham urged as much bipartisanship as possible. Bring in the Democrats. He wanted to provide a roadmap to Trump for dealing with Congress. "Mr. President, you've got to buy some Democrats," Graham said. "The good news is, they come cheap." He said that Trump needed to get to know key Republicans and Democrats. "Use your deal-making past and skills. You've got to put something on the table for these people. Look, I've been doing this with Republicans and Democrats for 10 years. "Would there be disagreements?" "Yes," he said. "Good friends disagree all the time. Washington is always about the next thing. After something doesn't work out, you've got to move on." The president had to knock off the tweeting. The week prior, on March 4th, he had sent out 4 tweets accusing Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower. "You've got an uppercut to the jaw delivered by you," Graham said of the widespread negative reaction to the tweets. "They're out to get you. Don't help them." "Tweeting," the president said. "That's the way I operate." "It's okay to tweet to your advantage, Mr. President. Don't tweet to your disadvantage. They're always trying to drag you into their swamp. You've got to have the discipline not to take the bait." Trump phoned Graham the next day to thank him for the discussion. "Invite John McCain and his wife Cindy to dinner," Graham said. "John is a good guy. You guys need to get along, and he can help you on lots of things." In 2015, Trump had made one of his most cruel and thoughtless comments about McCain. "He's not a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people who weren't captured." Graham knew McCain hated Trump. He knew that in Washington, you had to deal with people who hated you. But he did not impart that particular piece of advice to the president. "My chief job is to keep John McCain calm," Graham remarked. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was scared to death of John McCain, because John knows no boundaries. He'll pop our leadership as much as he'll pop their leadership. And I will at times, but mine's more calculated. John's just purely John. He's just the world's nicest man. And a media whore like me. Anyway, he's a much nicer guy than I am. The dinner with McCain and Cindy was arranged for April. Graham also attended. Cindy McCain had dedicated her life to fighting human trafficking, and Graham suggested that Trump make her his ambassador for that cause. At the dinner in the Blue Room, Trump pulled out a letter. He read it to Cindy McCain line by line, drawing it out. "I would very much like you to be my ambassador at large for human trafficking," he read, noting that she had devoted her life to human rights causes. "I'd be honored," she said, and teared up. McCain was visibly touched. As chairman of the Armed Services Committee, he also thanked the president for promising to rebuild the military. "What do you want us to do to help you?" McCain asked. "I just want to get to know you," Trump said, laying it on very thick. "I admire you. You're a very tough man. You're a good man." It was as close as he might get to, "I'm sorry." McCain again seemed touched. "It's a tough world out there," he said. "We want to help you." "What about North Korea?" Trump asked. "Everybody screwed this up," McCain said. "Democrats, Republicans, the last 3 presidents over 24 years, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Bill Clinton." "Here's the decision, Mr. President," Graham said, repeating what he'd already told Trump. "A containment strategy, let North Korea get the advanced missile with a nuclear weapon, betting you could shoot it down, or that they would be deterred and never shoot, or telling China that the United States would stop North Korea from getting the capability." "What do you think?" Trump asked McCain. "Very complicated," he said. "They can kill 1 million people in Seoul with conventional artillery. That's what makes it so hard." Graham offered a hawkish view. "If 1 million people are going to die, they're going to die over there. not here. That's pretty cold, Trump interjected. He said he believed that China loved him. He seemed to say it almost 10 times, and that it gave him great leverage. During a spring meeting in the Oval Office, discussion turned to the controversy in South Korea about the deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, THAAD, missile defense system, which had become an issue in the South Korean presidential race. The system would help protect South Korea from a North Korea missile attack. More crucially, it could be used to help protect the United States. "Have they already paid for it?" Trump asked. "They didn't pay for it," McMaster said. "We paid for it." "That can't be right," Trump said. He wanted an explanation, so McMaster set out to get some answers from the Pentagon. "It's actually a very good deal for us," McMaster said when he returned in the afternoon. "They gave us the land in a 99-year lease for free. But we pay for the system, the installation, and the operations." Trump went wild. "I want to see where it is going," he said. Finally, some maps came in that showed the location. Some of the land included a former golf course. "This is a piece of shit land," said the former golf course and real estate developer. "This is a terrible deal. Who negotiated this deal? What genius? Take it out. I don't want the land." The major missile defense system might cost $10 billion over 10 years, and it wasn't even physically in the United States, Trump said. "Fuck it. Pull it back and put it in Portland." Trump was still outraged by the $18 billion trade deficit with South Korea and wanted to pull out of what he called the horrible Chorus trade deal. Rising tensions around THAAD were bad enough. South Korea was a crucial ally and trade partner. Trump met with McMaster and Mattis. Both said that given the crisis with North Korea, it was not the time to bring up the trade deal. "That's exactly when you bring it up," Trump said. "If they want protection, this is when we get to renegotiate the deal. We have leverage." Trump later told Reuters that the initial cost for THAAD was an estimated $1 billion. "I informed South Korea it would be appropriate if they paid," he said. "It's a billion-dollar system. It's phenomenal. Shoots missiles right out of the sky." On April 30th, McMaster called the South Korean National Security Chief. He told Chris Wallace on Fox News, "What I told our South Korean counterpart is until any renegotiation, that the deal's in place. We'll adhere to our word." As a first step, the South Korean Trade Ministry later agreed to start to renegotiate the Chorus trade deal. Chapter 14. In February, Derek Harvey, a former Army colonel, one of the premier fact-driven intelligence analysts in the U.S. government, was appointed director for the Middle East on the National Security Council staff. It was a plum position in a region that was on fire. Harvey, a soft-spoken, driven legend, approached intelligence like a homicide detective, sifting through thousands of pages of interrogation reports, communications intercepts, battle reports, enemy documents, raw intelligence data, and non-traditional sources such as tribal leaders. The result was, at times, unorthodox thinking. In some circles, he was referred to as the grenade because of his ability and willingness to explode conventional wisdom. Before the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Harvey had written a paper concluding that Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network posed a strategic threat to the United States. He was almost alone in forecasting the persistence and power of the insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan after the U.S. invaded. His argument was often that certain aggressive, ambitious ideas were doable but not sellable, meaning the political system would not provide or sustain them, such as maintaining tens of thousands of U.S. troops in Afghanistan for years. Harvey went to see Jared Kushner, who had a small office adjacent to the Oval Office. Kushner sat back, crossed his legs, and listened to Harvey's case. Harvey's number one worry in the Middle East was Hezbollah, the Iranian-supported terrorist organization. The sensitive intelligence showed that Hezbollah had more than 48,000 full-time military in Lebanon, where they presented an existential threat to the Jewish state. They had 8,000 expeditionary forces in Syria, Yemen, and region-wide commando units. In addition, they had people worldwide, 30 to 50 each, in Colombia, Venezuela, South Africa, Mozambique, and Kenya. Hezbollah had a stunning 150,000 rockets. In the 2006 war with Israel, they'd had only 4,500. Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders were integrated into the Hezbollah structure. Iran was paying Hezbollah's bills at a staggering $1 billion a year. That did not include what Hezbollah made from money laundering, human trafficking, the cocaine and opium trades, and selling ivory tusks from Mozambique. Hezbollah dominated in Lebanon, a state within a state, with a willingness to use violence. Nothing of import happened in Lebanon without Hezbollah's acquiescence. It was committed to destroy Israel. Hezbollah was a perfect proxy for Iran to use to pressure and attack Israel, whose air bases could be pummeled with rockets. Israel's defenses of Iron Dome, David's Sling, and Arrow missiles would be inadequate. Harvey argued there was potential for a catastrophic war with immense humanitarian, economic, and strategic consequences. An Iranian-Israeli conflict would draw in the United States and unhinge efforts to bring regional stability. Trump was given a Reader's Digest version of the Hezbollah briefing. DNI Dan Coats and CIA Director Mike Pompeo supported the case in morning Oval Office PDB briefings. Mattis, McMaster, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson supported it in a matter-of-fact way. Harvey felt the others did not appreciate the degree to which the fundamental balance of power had shifted. Another Arab-Israeli war would come home to Israel as no attack ever had. A full-scale assault could impact their ability to actually fight. Harvey underscored this to Kushner strongly. The new Trump administration was unprepared for what could happen. He pushed to follow up on Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's agreements from their meeting in February, the importance of a strategic dialogue to take a fresh look and confront the new realities on the ground. He wanted to enhance the relationship that he believed had deteriorated over 8 years under the Obama administration. In the summer, the Israeli ambassador to Washington and its national security advisor wanted Harvey to come to Israel. McMaster said Harvey couldn't go, though he gave no reason. In early July, Harvey arranged to meet with senior intelligence officials from Mossad, military intelligence, and representatives from the Israeli Air Force and Army. McMaster, angry with Harvey, would not let him move forward. The big question: had Harvey uncovered the next ticking time bomb, Hezbollah, in the array of foreign policy problems facing the United States and Trump? Soon, Harvey was back to see Kushner. "What do you think about the president going to Riyadh as our first presidential trip?" Kushner asked. "It fits perfectly with what we're trying to do," Harvey said, "to reaffirm our support for the Saudis, our strategic objectives in the region. Our position has deteriorated so much during the Obama years." Harvey believed that Obama had spent too much time on mollifying Iran with the nuclear deal and neglecting, even scorning, relations with the Saudis and Israel. Making Saudi Arabia the first presidential trip could go a long way to signaling that the Trump administration had new priorities. It was also very attractive to Harvey that the president's first trip might be to his region, because all the other senior NSC staffers would be clamoring to have the first trip in theirs. A summit in Saudi Arabia would also benefit Israel. The Saudis and Israelis, both longtime foes of Iran, had both open and important back-channel relations. Harvey knew to focus rigorously on such a suggestion from Kushner, who was obviously not just another senior presidential advisor. The son-in-law was speaking with at least the president's knowledge, if not his encouragement. Harvey was as well connected as any intelligence officer to Israeli intelligence and knew that Kushner had established his own connections there. Netanyahu was a longtime Kushner family friend. Kushner told Harvey he had important and reliable intelligence that the key to Saudi Arabia was the deputy crown prince, the charismatic 31-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS. The son of the Saudi king, MBS was also the defense minister, a key position and launching pad for influence in the kingdom. MBS had vision, energy. He was charming and spoke of bold, modernizing reforms. When McMaster learned of Kushner's Saudi summit idea, he asked Harvey nervously, "Who's pushing this? Where's it coming from?" Harvey was not sure what role the president might or might not have. McMaster clearly disliked the out-of-channel approach, but there was not much he could do about it. Harvey held a series of meetings with the intelligence agencies, including the CIA. The message from them was that Kushner better be careful. The real solid guy was the current crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, 57, who was known as MBN. He was the king's nephew, credited with dismantling al-Qaeda in the kingdom as head of the interior ministry. Showing favoritism to the younger MBS would cause friction in the royal family. From decades of intelligence contacts in the Middle East, Harvey believed that Kushner was right. MBS was the future. MBS saw that transformative change in Saudi Arabia was the only path to survival for the kingdom. With Kushner as his patron, Harvey had unusual authority to begin planning. Harvey reached out to defense, treasury, and the White House National Economic Council. The risks, Harvey believed, were substantial, but he saw high, high upsides. In March, McMaster chaired a principals meeting on the possibility of a Saudi summit. "From my experience at Exxon," said Secretary of State Tillerson, waving his hand dismissively, "the Saudis always talk a big game. You go through the dance with them on the negotiations. When it comes time to putting the signature on the page, you can't get there." Engagement with MBS should be taken with a grain of salt. The U.S. could work hard on a summit and in the end have nothing. "It's a bridge too far," Mattis said. "Arranging arms sales and other projects beneficial to the United States economy, the necessary deliverables for such a summit, would take a long time. We're better off waiting until next year. A new administration should be more careful and prudent." Secretary of Energy Rick Perry said there was too much to do in too short a time. No one supported the idea of a summit in 2 months as Kushner was now proposing. Kushner sat at the opposite end of the table from McMaster. "I understand this is very ambitious," the president's son-in-law said. He stood. "I understand the concerns, but I think we have a real opportunity here. We have to recognize it. I understand we have to be careful. We need to work this diligently as if it's going to happen. And if it looks like we can't get there, we'll have plenty of time to shift gears. But this is an opportunity that is there for the seizing." No one said no. Harvey knew they really couldn't, and he continued to plan as if it were going to happen. He set some thresholds, deciding that they would have to have over $100 billion in military contracts agreed on beforehand. Execution fell to Harvey. MBS sent a team of 30 to Washington, and Harvey arranged multiple conference rooms in the Eisenhower office building. Working groups of Americans and Saudis were set up on terrorism, terrorism financing, violent extremism, and information campaigns. The Pentagon held meetings on contracts and security partnerships. Harvey did not want to ask too much of the Saudis, who he knew did not have as deep pocketbooks as generally thought. Oil prices had dropped, cutting into Saudi revenue. McMaster was still not enthusiastic. "Because Kushner wants it," he told Harvey, "we need to keep working it. But there's not a lot of support for it. We'll go through the motions, and then we'll kill it at some point. Kushner said that if the United States was going to stay engaged in the region, they needed to help the Saudis and Israelis succeed. The president was not going to continue paying the bills for U.S. defense in the Middle East when the primary